You're listening to TGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
It is remarkable that we've been living with these bombs for so long and no one has dropped another one, you know, in a conflict or been an accident. But the difficult thing about nuclear weapons is there's no guarantee that holds forever. You know, a lot of people have the idea that if I have nuclear weapons and you have nuclear weapons, we won't attack each other because we're afraid of retaliation. No one knows whether that is, you know, will be true for forever, and it seems unlikely that it will be.
That's Sarah Scholes. This is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Sarah Scholes on nuclear weapons and the future of the planet. The award-winning Oppenheimer film has brought attention to the origins of the atomic bomb and the anguish of its inventor. Almost 80 years after that first explosion in New Mexico, the threat of global Armageddon not only remains, but has increased. Until and unless nuclear weapons are abolished, humankind will always be in danger of massive death and destruction. Yet, instead of moving toward abolition, the U.S. is upgrading its arsenal. The doomsday clock is ticking. Sooner or later, intentionally or unintentionally, terminal war will destroy the planet. The only way to prevent that from happening is to eliminate all nuclear weapons. As long as they exist, humanity hangs by a thread. Our guest today is Sarah Scholes. She's an award-winning science journalist. Her articles appear in the New York Times, Wired, and the Scientific American. She's the author of Countdown, The Blinding Future of Nuclear Weapons. She spoke at the Boulder Bookstore in late February.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm hoping this talk won't fill you with too much existential dread, even though it's about like the world's most deadliest weapons. But we'll see. You can report back afterwards. Tell me what you think. Too much, too little. I was just going on a road trip somewhere. I don't know. I was probably doing some weird camping trip or something, and I was going to be driving through New Mexico. And I'm lucky enough to be a science reporter, and so I saw that Los Alamos National Lab and Sandia National Laboratories, they were on the way to where I was going. And these are both labs that are run by the Department of Energy and its National Nuclear Security Administration. And the Department of Energy is kind of cleverly named so that you don't fully realize that it's the agency in charge of maintaining our nuclear weapons. And so I saw these labs and I said, hey, can I stop by and just see what you guys are up to, talk to some of your scientists, learn about all this? And they said, sure, come on by. And I was like, oh, weird. Awesome. I will. But when I got there, what they talked to me about were not nuclear weapons. It was about like supernovae and nuclear power and solar panels and geology on Mars. Neutrinos, yeah. All kinds of interesting, cool science things, but not nuclear weapons. And in actuality, you know, their real mandate, and I think around 70% of their funding do go toward nuclear weapons. And so I was like, you know, what's up with that? Why aren't you talking to me about what it is you really do? And so I started trying to figure that out, starting with the scientists that I was talking to about black holes and supernovae and neutrinos and things like that. And it turned out that they were the same scientists who worked on nuclear weapons, because a supernova in space is essentially a nuclear bomb going off constantly very far away. And so eventually I tried to gain the trust of these scientists and eventually say, okay, now let's be real. Can we talk about nuclear weapons? Of course, nuclear weapons and their history began during the Manhattan Project, which... who saw Oppenheimer? Almost everybody. So you probably got a little bit of an extra glimpse into the Manhattan Project, but it was this secret program to develop nuclear weapons without mostly any oversight or anyone knowing about it, even though around 100,000 people worked on the program, and most of them didn't really know exactly what they were working on. But there were labs and production sites across the United States, particularly in Washington State, Tennessee, and of course, our friend to the south, New Mexico. And in just 3 years, the Manhattan Project scientists were able to develop two different kinds of nuclear bombs, which they, of course, proceeded, well, they didn't, the United States proceeded to drop them on Japan near the end of World War II. And after that, we just kind of kept going. We kept building more bombs and more powerful bombs, and so did the Soviet Union after that, and then so eventually did other countries. And at the height of the Cold War, this is a crazy figure to me, but there were 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world, which is at least one too many. And today, we've decided that is a little excessive and cut it back to around 13,000, which is also a pretty high number. But the United States right now has more than 5,000 weapons in its possession, including ones that are retired but yet to be dismantled, which is also probably enough, right, to do whatever you would like to do with nuclear weapons. But there is a problem with them, at least according to some experts, which is that they are mostly decades old, some many decades old. And that has some people worried about whether nuclear weapons are, what they say at these labs is, safe, secure, and reliable. That is their tagline. And the analogy they use is, you know, you wouldn't buy a car in 1985, put it in your garage, turn it on in 2024 and expect it to act like it did in 1985 when you bought it. Or maybe you would. I don't know what you guys would do. But they're also worried about whether they will work as intended and be as effective as intended, where effective is like a euphemism for very deadly. Additionally, they're worried because other countries, particularly Russia and China, are also modernizing or expanding their set of nuclear weapons. And it's like a radioactive keeping up with the Joneses situation. And so we have this big modernization program that I was mentioning that is going to cost between $1 and $2 trillion, probably closer to $2 trillion over the course of 30 years, which is more than my allowance, I think. But this modernization program, in some cases, aims to just, you know, replace regular parts on weapons that might have degraded as time went on, like electronics and fuses. In other cases, it means adding new sensors that change how and when nuclear weapons would explode if they were going to explode. And also, we are designing the first new nuclear weapon that we have done since the Cold War, which is kind of wild to have not done it for so long and be doing it right now. And the biggest change, though, to me is a program called the Plutonium Pit Production Program. But a plutonium pit is basically a hollow sphere of plutonium metal that's in the middle of nuclear weapons that sets off the rest of the explosion. So these plutonium pits, they're plutonium metal, which kind of just looks like dull silver mixed with gallium, and they are at the center of nuclear weapons, and they're surrounded by regular explosives, kind of like fancy TNT, and that if you pressed go on a weapon, those explosives would detonate and push all that plutonium together, and that would start a critical fission reaction where the plutonium would start to split and perpetuate itself. And then that would, in turn, affect a second part of the weapon that is the more powerful part, the fusion part, and it would start to ignite this fusion reaction of pushing smaller atoms together to make larger atoms and releasing lots of energy in the process, where lots of energy, as with everything here, is a euphemism for, like, lots of really deadly, unpleasant stuff. The youngest pits we have right now were made in the late 1980s, and we used to make them at Rocky Flats, which I imagine a lot of people here are familiar with. Oh, yeah, there's a picture of Rocky Flats. Has anybody been hiking in Rocky Flats? It's a hiking spot now. Yeah, it's a wildlife refuge now. I hear it has a herd of elk, but it used to be the site of the major place of plutonium pit production. And today we're going to be making 80 of these plutonium pits per year. But back then, they were making more than 1,000 pits per year. But the way you can do something like make 1,000 pits per year is by, like, not really obeying very many environmental regulations and things like that. So back in the late 1980s, the Rocky Flats production plant was raided by the FBI and the EPA for pretty big environmental violations that required a years-long cleanup, many, many, many monies toward that cleanup. Now the elk get to live there, and you can go hike there. I think it's very close to here. But obviously, when that happened, we stopped making them. We were like, we had enough. They did kind of a bad job. We can leave it alone. But now, you know, we're trying to replace them. There is no more Rocky Flats, and nobody wants to do it the way Rocky Flats did it, because the elk have a place to live already. So they are spooling up plutonium pit production in Los Alamos and at a site in South Carolina called the Savannah River site. And they're hiring thousands of people to do this work, and they're going to work literally 24/7 on it as soon as they actually get started. As with everything in the government, it's behind schedule and over budget. But as you can imagine, anything involving plutonium is kind of a controversial program, and this is no exception. The arguments for making these new plutonium pits is that, you know, plutonium's point is that it's radioactive. It's constantly decaying, splitting out a smaller atom, particles, energy, and that creates impurities in the pit, and it also, like, the atoms knock each other around, and so the structure of it is different than it used to be. And, you know, maybe that means bad things for the pits in the future. And we don't know. There's no indications right now that there are any problems, but the proponents of pit production say before there are problems, we should try to revamp this infrastructure, be able to do this so that the nuclear weapons are still effective, there's not some kind of accident. And so as a very, very expensive insurance policy, we should get this thing going again. But there are also pretty solid arguments against this plan. The first one, I think, probably being what happened at Rocky Flats. No one wants that again. People are very reasonably afraid of environmental or maybe just personal contamination. Like, it's dangerous work for the people who are doing it. And the site in South Carolina where they will be making these, actually, it already has radioactive wildlife. It has radioactive roaches running around, allegedly, radioactive alligators. And there's an annual deer hunt on site where before you're allowed to take your deer home, you have to get it scanned to see if you got a radioactive deer, which, I don't know. You know, there's pros and cons to that. But, you know, aside from that, there's the argument that if everything so far indicates that the plutonium pits are fine and there are no problems, why are you spending so much money doing such dangerous work to replace them? Maybe it's to keep these labs like Los Alamos and the site in Savannah River in business, and maybe it's to put them in new weapons, which is actually what we're doing first before replacing the old ones and old weapons. We're putting them in new weapons. I don't know. We could take a vote on what you guys think about plutonium pit production if you want. But it's hard for people like us to really, you know, figure out which side of it to be on, because there's just not that much information out there. So lots of information relating to nuclear weapons, even stuff that might seem kind of innocuous, is what's called born classified, which means that, like, if I knew something about nuclear weapons and I wrote it down, it would be classified immediately, even if it was, I think, even if it was just me writing it down. Like, the stuff is just, it's just classified. And so you have to work to declassify it, which doesn't happen very often. And that information includes stuff you wouldn't expect. Like, I'm going to talk in a minute about a woman named Tess Light, and she helps look for nuclear detonations from space. So she has sensors on satellites, looks down, sees if anyone is exploding a nuclear weapon. And that happens because you can see, like, a burst of energy from it, obviously a large burst of energy. The sensors that she works on also pick up other stuff that is bursts of energy, particularly lightning. And she actually discovered this, like, cool phenomenon where there's this, like, very specific signature of lightning that happens right before a tornado, or not right before, before a tornado, where you can predict tornadoes earlier and with more accuracy than we can now. But she can't release that to anyone because it came from a nuclear sensor. So it's classified. Yeah, she says it's born classified, but it's lightning. And so I think people like her inside the nuclear infrastructure are just as frustrated as people on the outside. in the course of writing this book, I met a lot of very interesting people who work at the weapons labs. They kept their classified secrets, but they did tell me some information. So I can't tell you about too much about this lightning signature because it's born classified and I don't have access to that. But there is a lot of work that goes on at the labs that they can talk about, and not all of it has to do with building or designing nuclear weapons or stuff like that. A lot of the work they do is with a program called Stockpile Stewardship, which is a euphemism, like everything else. But it means we have this stockpile of nuclear weapons, and we can't test them anymore. Like, to find out if they work, we used to just blow them up. We used to take them out to Nevada or the Pacific Ocean and go press go and be like, did it work? Great. Does it not work? Okay, let's find out why. And now we can't do that. Rightfully, you know, it's not a great thing for political stability or like the atmosphere. Now we have to do small scale experiments and supercomputer simulations to try to figure out the kinds of things that we could just figure out by pressing detonate before. Someone told me it was like, you have a phone, you want to know if it turns on, works as expected. In a different world, in our world, you can just turn it on and find out. But in the world where you can't test it, you have to understand every capacitor, every resistor, all the parts of the circuit, and be able to model it in a computer and then say, I can tell you for sure that when this phone turns on, it'll work exactly as expected, which is pretty difficult. So there's a lot of people who work on that, and there's also people who work on things like non-proliferation and global security, which some people would say is the opposite of, you know, working on nuclear weapons, even though they coexist at the same lab. And so that's a long-winded way of saying these people work in global security and non-proliferation. And Tess Light, like I said, she's the one with the classified lightning data. She started out as an astronomer, just studying stars. And then when she went off to like try to find a job, she thought, you know, stars are interesting. I love this physics, but I don't find it particularly personally satisfying to just be adding knowledge to the universe about the universe. And so she started looking around for other kinds of jobs and saw one at Los Alamos. She thought, you know, I like people. I don't want to blow them up. I don't want to work at a weapons lab. But she found the Global Security and Non-Proliferation Division, and they said, you know, you can take your expertise in stars and apply it to looking for the same kinds of radiation coming from the ground where someone is doing a nuclear test. So today she works on these sensors that fly on GPS satellites, which, you know, we think of as a way to get to the grocery store or to come to this bookstore. They also have a sensor that is constantly watching for whether anyone is blowing up a nuclear weapon, which is kind of wild. And she, you know, she took her astronomical expertise and applied it to Earth. And we need those kinds of programs for like enforcing the treaty that says we're not going to test nuclear weapons. So if you can, you have to be able to tell whether anyone is breaking it for it to be a meaningful agreement. That's what she does. And she teamed up with a guy named Josh Carmichael. And he also came from like a regular science background. He's a seismologist. And so he used to do things like go to Antarctica, put these sensors in the ice to see if the ice was shaking like an earthquake, but that was to measure like how it was changing with climate change and how it was moving and things like that. But you will be unsurprised to know that seismometers are also useful for detecting nuclear explosions, because when that happens, the ground shakes. And so he'd been working for a few years on a program to bring together different kinds of signals. So when a nuclear weapon goes off, the ground shakes. There's obviously radioactivity in the air. Radio waves come out of it. There's this thing called infrasound, which is like sound deeper, lower than sound. And you put all those things together and you can know that something is a nuclear weapon going off. And so he had been working on a computer program to kind of automate that. And then he teamed up with Tess Light to combine her GPS signals with his on-the-ground signals and make it more automatic, which is pretty cool, because I couldn't believe when I found out that the way they do it now is like, you know, maybe you're a seismology expert and you're an expert in radio waves and you love infrasound. If we thought somebody had perhaps detonated a nuclear weapon and we saw some of those signals, I would like call you individually and ask you if you thought it was a nuclear weapon before we did. It's a very like manual, kind of tedious process that's not automatic. And so they're trying to make it more automatic, which is interesting to me at least. Then we have this guy, Chris Fryer. He's a computational physicist, which means that he's one of the people who kind of models the physics in a supercomputer, combining experiments that he does with digital simulations of things going on in the real world. And it is true what it says here, that he knows more about plasma than you, unless there's something about you that I don't know. But He founded this thing called the Center for Nonlinear Studies at Los Alamos. And a nonlinear thing is any kind of system like the climate or global health or something, where if you have a certain set of initial conditions, like the way things start out, and then you change it a tiny bit, the outcome you get is like wildly different. So that's like the weather. It's why the Colorado weather forecasts are always wrong. It's because they are nonlinear and there's a lot of variables going on. And so he founded this place to bring in young scientists who were studying nonlinear things that were not nuclear, like the weather or like this, you know, the spread of a pandemic or things like that. And then it's very clever what he does. He helps them make their methods of determining that better, and then takes their regular science and goes back to his classified hidey hole and applies it to the nuclear weapons work. That is actually the way that a lot of people end up working at nuclear weapons labs, is like getting recruited for the regular science that they're interested in and then saying, you know, here's this other classified weapons effort. We want you to get involved in that. And also we have more money and more resources than the science that you were doing before. But at the same time, the work that he's doing is advancing things like weather prediction and pandemic spread and other things like that. So the last person I'll tell you about, her name is Laura Berzac Hopkins. She might know more about plasma than Chris Fryer, but she's a plasma physicist. She works at a facility called the National Ignition Facility, which you might have heard about like a year ago. I guess you would have heard about it because it does fusion, and it's touted as a way to have fusion energy, which is kind of like the holy grail of the nuclear power sector. And they reached this point where they got more energy out of their fusion reaction than they put in. And but hopefully you know by now that it's not actually about fusion energy, it's about nuclear weapons. So the basics of it are that it is, I think, the world's most powerful laser. It's like 192 separate laser beams put together that all zoom in on this one piece of fusion fuel, energize it a lot, induce this fusion, and hopefully you get more energy out than you put in. And yeah, sure, that's like kind of useful for nuclear power, sort of, but like you're not going to build that in Boulder to like have fusion power. It's huge, it's expensive, it took a long time to build, it's like not the best way to go about it. So that's PR. But it's also useful for things like stars, like learning about how stars work or how supernovae work or things like that. But of course, it's also the same as what's going on in a nuclear weapon, or a way to, they put electronics that are inside nuclear weapons next to that reaction to see if a nuclear weapon can survive another nuclear weapon. So Hopkins gave me some interesting insight, which I imagine is somewhat controversial insight, which is that the basic science work that this does on things like stars is useful for weapons, even though it's not about weapons, because you can go publish a paper about a star, you can go write a press release about nuclear power, which you can't do really about the weapons work. And so you are kind of broadcasting to nuclear physicists the world over this information, like under the radar. If they see what you can do with a supernova, they know what you can do with a nuclear weapon, or they know what you know about nuclear weapons, but you don't have to tell them. You can just tell them about supernovae and then they can read into it. And so she's doing basic science as part of nuclear deterrence, which I thought was interesting. So it's kind of like science is the loud part, the weapons are the quiet part. I want nuclear weapons to be the loud part too. Not loud like when they go off, I hope that never happens, but just I think we should talk about them more than we do, especially with this big modernization program going on. And because even when we don't think about it, like every international interaction includes them. When our country interacts with any other country, it knows, oh, that country has nuclear weapons, and that affects how things go. So I was going to read the come to Jesus moment that one of the scientists I talked to had while I was speaking to him. His name is Mark Paris, and he is a cosmologist. So he used to study the beginning of the universe and how things got started. And then he kind of got interested in nuclear weapons. And lucky for him, he worked at Los Alamos, so he could go research them. But he's conflicted about it. And Mark Paris still believes that understanding physics is important to a better nuclear future, although he's pretty uncertain about the nuclear present these days. Like everyone, he's worried a weapon might again, maybe soon, be used in anger. But if models of moving particles are hard to get right, if he cannot see their futures, that's even more true of the large mammals lording over this planet. The biggest mistake I see scientists making is to extrapolate their ability to predict in highly prescribed systems, he says. They tend to think they can generalize and take that to more complex systems like human relations. To me, it's folly and nonsensical to attempt that. Given that, he can't say how likely he thinks it is that someone will detonate a nuclear weapon, but he does believe he can predict something about what he himself will do in that case, at least if he survives, and so do his career choices. If that terrible eventuality should occur, agnostic the perpetrator, it will change my life, he says. I don't know exactly how, but I know it will. I will do something. I will certainly have to rethink working, he continues, at a place like this. He looks around at the tables full of coffee sippers, the highway full of cars that made it through the lab's gates, the buildings full of people imperfectly working out the futures of various things. I think that eventuality, which hopefully never occurs, calls into question the foundation of the existence of the lab's mission, he says. It's a somewhat faltering and circuitous statement, but it means that if a nuclear bomb goes off, deterrence has failed. Its philosophy, which is the philosophy of stockpile stewardship, has been proven false. In that case, keeping the weapons because they would keep the peace didn't, in fact, keep the peace. It only kept the weapons. That's what he thought. I think that can be the end of my talking, and well, thanks.
You're listening to Sarah Scholes on nuclear weapons and the future of the planet. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
The subtitle of your book is The Blinding Future of Nuclear Weapons. I'm curious about the word blinding.
I think that blinding, it kind of encapsulates a few aspects of nuclear weapons. Like, you know, if one ever went off again, it would be very blinding. It also speaks to the fact that nuclear weapons are such a large part of our world society right now, even if we're not talking about them, that they can kind of fill the whole field of view and blind you to other things, for better or for worse. I don't think we know what the future holds for nuclear weapons, and so in some ways they blind us to themselves. Mm-hmm.
You say nuclear weapons are today as important as they were during the Cold War. And some experts say we could be as close to a nuclear catastrophe now as we were at the height of that conflict. Despite that, you write, conversations about nuclear bombs generally often happen in past tense. Why is that?
I think after the Cold War ended, everybody kind of got used to thinking about nuclear weapons less. You know, during the Cold War, they were on everyone's mind. There were air raid drills, you know, constant tension. And then once the Cold War ended, I think there was a feeling in and out of the nuclear establishment that we were going to become less dependent on them. And so our thinking about them just kind of went away, but they've always been there in the background. And, you know, the longer you have them, the more you have, the likelier there is to be an accident. And then also right now, you know, we have new and maybe more complicated conflicts involving nuclear states than we did during the Cold War.
Well, is there anything that could have been done at that time